Talk given Friday, 8th February 1974. We have been meeting for some years now with the idea that our concern is religion, living the religious life or the holy life. How much do we understand by the religious life? What do we mean by living the religious life or the holy life? We have considered a few times one very important point in this connection, namely that for us we must not separate the holy life from everyday life. That is to say, have one conception, one attitude, one approach to everyday life, which is not entirely in harmony with what we call or imagine we understand as the religious life. The two have to be an identity. We all know the commoner garden phrase, private morality and public morality. When our private and public morality is the pure morality as understood in the religious sense, in the profoundly religious sense, then we are living the religious life. But what is it that determines this morality? What is it that moves us to undertake certain practices like meditation, meeting together, discussing, studying the scriptures or whatever it is, and so forth? What is it that moves us? Is it not our own particular conceptions about the religious life? And can we at all assume that our conceptions are true conceptions? Consider one point, for instance. Life is not static. It continuously moves. The tendency of life is to grow, as we say, and to come to fruition. Now, are we aware of the trend of life which brings us to fruition? Note carefully, are we aware? In other words, have we true insight into that? Or have we a fixed conception about it? Or at least a more or less fixed conception? Because all fixed conceptions are against life in the true sense of the word life. That which is living that which is growing and coming to fulfillment, to fruition, is that which is everlastingly changing. It never is static. A conception arises in relation to a particular situation. It is like a still photograph. Unlike a film, a cinema film, let us say, which will go on continuously every moment we are alive till we die. It's not like that. It's just one particular still taken out of incalculable millions of stills, all of which are different from each other. So a conception is something which emerges in the moment. It may be in line with the truth, or, as generally happens, it is not in line with the truth. If it is in line with the truth, the reality, then it is useful for a time, for a very short time maybe. If it tends to stay put, then it is the enemy of the religious life. Because this change which is taking place as one lives must take place. Otherwise, there is an obstruction to the process of growth and fulfillment. Now, usually the conception is not in line with the truth. It is all, in fact, one may with fair certainty say, it is always a misconception. For the very simple reason that our concept-forming mechanism, our intellectual processes, are conditioned by our upbringing, our society, our culture, and so on. Those around us, the compulsion of circumstance, the confusion in ourselves when we come up against the conflicts and pressures of life, and so forth. This is the great difficulty with conceptions. But people normally know no better. They are always searching for a new concept, a new idea. They everlastingly forget that the idea is not the inspirer in actual fact. The idea, the concept, is something which the living person's mind, the living mind, excretes. It throws out of itself in the process of the mental life. Just as in the process of the physical life, there is that which is physically thrown out of us. It's the not wanted where we are concerned. It's the same with ideas, beliefs, convictions, and the whole lot of them. And yet, we talk about living the religious life tied down to concepts. A blueprint of how we ought to live, we ought to grow. But this is completely laughable. Which human mind can grasp the wonder and the infinitude of life and the life process? The human mind can put itself into harmony with that, be inspired by that, and in the process of being inspired, the brain will throw out concepts. Because the business of the brain is to use what is practically its most important faculty, its power of speech, to structure the inspiration. If the inspiration isn't structured, it just dissipates. But the structure must never be a concrete structure. The structure has to have the total elasticity of the life process itself. We are a little bit, in certain respects, in the Alice in Wonderland condition here. And that is the right condition, really. The mysterious happens. The extraordinary happens. So now you see, we talk about, we are concerned with religion and living the religious life. No one needs challenge the sincerity of it. But we must always keep challenging the exactitude of it, the rightness of it. Are we? Or are we fooling ourselves a little bit, playing a game with ourselves, and just finding an escape from reality? Finding ways and means to find a pleasure and security and so forth, which belongs to us in our childish state, in our childhood only. In other words, we never become mature adults where the mind is concerned. We are afraid of life, so we want shelter, shelter, shelter all the time. Or to put it rather non-optimistically, we are always like drowning people clutching at straws. This is very important. We must realize this. Otherwise, we'll never escape this tendency to clutch at the straw. We'll never escape that tendency. If we understand the abstract fact that life has its purposive drive to bring to fulfillment, and life alone knows, if we may use the word know in this context, life alone knows what that fulfillment means and is. I, the ordinary person, conditioned with my drawbacks, my difficulties, I, the ordinary person, must try to be watchful, truly attentive to what is happening, what is actually present outside and within myself, and thus try to live consciously in tune with the tremendous natural drive of life itself. This is an extremely difficult task. Difficult fundamentally for the reason that the body, derived from its primordial ancestor, some animal, has the animal nature in it, the good animal nature, which is concerned with the preservation of the organism and the perpetuation of the species. And those drives are in us, strongly. The animal, to put it in human philosophical terms, draws from the world unto itself and comes to full maturity as an organism, fulfills its purpose, and dies. Man, being different from the animal, particularly in this respect, that he can look within himself and is capable of self-cognition and has developed the intellectual side of him with all that that implies, and this tremendous field of culture has another aspect to him. And this other aspect, the profoundly cultural, culminating in culture in the sense of religion itself, is one which ceases to draw from the world unto oneself, but works for the unification of the self with the totality. And then individuality, in the full human sense, is realized. This is, if you like, the true meaning of self-realization. Nothing to do with my separate, restricted self. This unifying with the totality in consciousness, because it can only be done in consciousness, in awareness, in a complete, constant awareness, which has become second nature to us. Now, these two aspects, at first, and the first lasts a very long, long time, until the very last, when the whole thing is over, there is nothing in between, so to say. At first, these two are in conflict with each other. The drawing to oneself, and the other which sees that one must move out into the totality and be at one with the totality. Which means that my interests and your interests and so forth are never in conflict. And how is it that they can never, how can it come about that they will never be in conflict? Because if we look at life, if we look at mankind through the ages, man is always struggling with man. As a matter of fact, it's very topical just at present in this country, isn't it? In fact, all over the world. Man is always in conflict with his fellow man. Now, how then shall my interests and your interests not be in conflict? If I, the individual, you, the individual, who are striving to live the religious life, to understand what it means to live the religious life, look at all those with whom you or I come in contact, you will see that they are by no means concerned or will be concerned with giving up their interests. They are the irreligious ones. We are the semi-religious ones because we are undergoing a conflict. And when does that conflict end? Not when the other fellow does this, that or the other, as far as his interests are concerned, because he will keep them. But I have to be totally free of all interests, including the interest to live the religious life. Because if the living of the religious life is a vested interest with me, I will inevitably have concepts about it. And I, the imperfect creature, will inevitably have imperfect concepts about it. Now you see the situation. the enormous difficulty involved in it. If you really understand this, when you come across all these charming people who say, oh, come into our group and carry out this little technique and that little method and you will be in nirvana, they are just as much ordinary exploiters and pleasure seekers and irreligious people as anybody else, perhaps worse in some respects. Beware of all that, beware. You see, it is precisely this sort of being able to penetrate into the truth, the reality of the situation, which means that there is a coming to fruition. And I can never see the picture of that fruition. If I am a bud, have I any concept? Can I form a picture of what I, the bud, will be like if I'm not blighted but do flower out into the flower? I have no concept at all. Isn't it marvelous that nature has made us in such a way that the eyes look outwards? I can't see my own face. And isn't that the beauty of the whole situation? Because that is an innocent state. That is a pure state. You just flower. And in that flowering, and if you're a human, you do it consciously too, up to a point consciously anyway. If you are a human, you are never tainted with any vested interest in that flowering. And you never spoil it. And you never spoil the process. You never spoil the fulfillment itself by putting concepts upon it. This is very important. Now, if we can really get hold of this, meditate deeply upon it. It needs profound meditation. We'll begin to understand that marvelous sentence out of so many marvelous sentences, which I'm so fond of quoting from the Tejobindu Upanishad. I am the I which has given up I. Consider what is woven round that word I. All the vested interests, all bondage, all ill comes out of this misconceived I. I am the I that has given up I. This is said by Shiva, the third person of the Trinity. Very significant that the words, it's a divine dialogue between the disciple. It is supposed to be his own grandson, Kumara, who asks the question. And the Lord of the universe answers, I am the I that has given up I. The question which is asked is, it's not so much a question as a request. Please explain to me the meaning of Atma realization. You see? Now, we mentioned the word attentiveness, complete and total attention to that which we say is outside us and to that which is within us. What is the nature of this attention? Do we really know what attention means? We'd be very safe in acknowledging that we do not know what attention means. we imagine we are being attentive, and we sincerely believe we are attentive. What makes us believe we are attentive? Well, of course, I've been taught to be attentive by my parents when I was a little chap, by my teachers at school, and so forth. Yes, our faculty of attention was used by us in our childhood and in our school days and so forth as we grew up. And so we grow up, so when we are grown up, we believe that the manner in which we used that power of attention was the right thing. Is it? Is it attention? Now remember, this word attention is associated with the word chit in Sanskrit. Chit. Attention, attentiveness. It also means consciousness. It also means thought and all the concomitants which arise with the thought process. Chit, consciousness. And this word chit is associated with the ultimate reality, with God, with Brahman. Brahman is described as Sat Chit Ananda, being, consciousness, bliss. But if Brahman is the totality, what is the meaning of consciousness in connection with totality? The meaning of consciousness in connection with totality is of necessity something utterly different, inconceivably different from the meaning of consciousness for us. We are conscious only in terms of separation. I am conscious of that chair or this microphone or of you or you or you sitting here. There is the instrumentality of my senses at play. I see. And because I'm paying attention, because that which is impressed at the back of my brain by my eyes and my sense of sight has been seen before so many times, and it has a name already, and there is a concept from childhood onwards, which tells me that that is a chair, or that is a man, you see. Because of that, I see, and I form a concept, and I say, I am conscious of it. Actually, I am seeing my particular mental concept, not the thing in itself. Is it possible to see the thing in itself? And all the great philosophers, especially from Immanuel Kant to our own times, are completely agreed that it is not possible to see the thing in itself. I'm deliberately using the word see at first, because the word see is associated with the functioning of a sense, the sense of sight. And the senses are avenues for conveying that which is other than myself to myself. That is all. You see their limitation. But now, to be conscious of something might be something immeasurably more. More not in terms of sense as such, that the sense conveys more in the sense, in the sensible way, but to be conscious might mean something utterly different. Perhaps To be conscious means to be in total union with, without naming anything, without any separation, separateness involved in it. One could almost say to be conscious in the supreme sense means to be it. If that is the case, then to see a thing in itself means to be conscious in this manner. But am I the ordinary man of the world, fallible, incapable? Can I possibly be conscious in this manner? At this moment, I can't, obviously. But if I look into it like this, not just analytically, but really paying what we call paying attention to it, I will begin to understand the meaning of paying attention. Let us take the thing a little more concretely. I am speaking here. You sitting there are listening. Now, if what I say grips your attention, as we say in common language, you will naturally be attending to me. If after a few minutes the fascination disappears or lessens, your attention will begin to wander, as we say. So now, right from the start, is it true attention which depends upon being fascinated by? Like a child is fascinated with a toy with which it is playing. The toy absorbs the mind, absorbs the attention of the child. The toy takes over the mind of the child. The child is not attending. The child is only entrapped by the impression created by the toy. Our living the religious life, etc., is that sort of thing. We don't attend to it. We are not conscious of it. We are taken over by our concept or our desire to live the religious life. And the term the religious life is just a phrase which produces an impression upon us that this way we shall be happy, that we shall become fulfilled, and so forth. And above all, that we shall be compensated for all we have missed, for our frustrations, that it will be a refuge, a fortress to which we can retreat because we are incapable of facing life and its pressures and its difficulties. It's a retreat from life. Do try and get this in the depths. Today, in this century at least, today more than ever, this world is going nearer and nearer the precipice. And it is only people like ourselves who, if we truly understand, will be the instruments through whom get released psychical mental energies which start a transformation. You and I will not see the result. We should not want to see the result. That is just folly. Because if we predetermine a result, that is the best way to defeat truth and reality. The best way, the surest way. But this is the great value of understanding the inner depths which are involved, the nature of attentiveness. It's so difficult to attend, believe me, because we constantly react for or against to every stimulus that comes to us. Till we reach a cracking point, and then we give up. We turn tail and run away. Now, we can reach a cracking point and maybe be cracked and yet not turn tail and run away. What do we do then? In that situation, I mean. What do we do? We truly recognize that I can't do anything about this. I don't know it. I don't understand it. When I know that I don't know and that I'm incapable, if I truly know it, truly understand it, truly feel it inside, then I won't get upset about it. I become calm. I just be quiet. Not waiting for an answer, but I just become quiet. And in that quietude, there is the rejuvenation of the intelligence, the mind. There is a recharging of the psycho-spiritual batteries. Exactly as when the body is tired and worn out, and it really goes into deep dreamless slumber, it is brought back to life again, recharged for the next day. Not by me, not by this, that, or the other cause on which I can lay my finger, but by this mysterious, wonderful, beautiful thing called life. Transcendence itself. So now, when I get quiet like this, I am in the truly attentive state. You may remember, I haven't spoken of it for some time, but some time past, I have suggested that it is helpful to regard mind as the receptive, responsive sensitivity characterizing the living human body. Mind is the receptive, responsive sensitivity characterizing the living human body. Now, when I'm quiet in the right way, and I'm naturally attentive, then at last this mind is truly mind. And it functions in the right way. And then it is not the mind in the sense of, in the commoner garden sense of my mind, which works out what should be done, but it being in the empty state, the transparent state, the light of truth comes and plays through it and moves the person, me, myself, you, yourself, to a procedure. And whatsoever happens in that procedure, whether it be painful or pleasant to me, is the right thing for the coming to fruition. Now, if I can truly recognize that and let it happen unobstructedly, then I have understood the meaning of living the religious life. This is religion. As we can all see, it's no joke. It is climbing Everest, minus oxygen masks and all the rest of the claptrap. Walking up to the top of Everest naked, without any practice. But the miracle is this, that a man can do it. And why on earth do I, an ordinary fellow, say this? Well, you and I know well enough that it has been done. Through the ages, life has blessed mankind with the specimens of the fruition of humanity. They are the first fruits of humanity, the inspiring beacons whose inspiring power will never diminish, whose light will never go out. It is like this. I was born, I live, I shall die. But the stars in the heavens were shining incalculable ages before I was born and will continue to shine incalculable ages afterwards. It is in that way that the inspiration and light of the Holy Ones is everlasting. So you see, we don't have to summon up courage or somehow rouse up hope. It is there naturally. But we are a little bit like those dear little fish, you know, who started inquiring, water? What is this strange thing, water? We flaunt the words, in him we live and move and have our being, and you know, you say it in the right tone of voice and anything, and everybody says, oh, what a marvelous man, what a beautiful speaker and all that. It's a tamasha, it's a show. It's humbug, charming humbug if you like. But it does represent also the truth, the absolute truth. It is so true that like the fish who inquired what on earth is water, we are like that. What on earth is human fulfillment? What is transcendence and so forth? This strange thing, transcendent, God and so forth. And look at the way we have fought with each other over the word which is truth. Always remember Puck. Lord, what fools these mortals be. And I say it because I myself go through this constantly, and I have to be Puck to myself and say, Lord, what a fool you are. So you see, when one really begins to understand, and one is quiet, empty, transparent, and the light of reality begins to shine through unhindered, then the state of active, creative hopefulness is there naturally. I don't have to rouse up hope. Because rousing up hope, look carefully into the mind and see how it works. Rousing up hope means making a particular picture of how I would like it to be. And the Lord God shouts, "Stop interfering with my work, you fool, making those pictures. You're spoiling the beauty of the void plenitude." It's hard for us to do it because I'm never prepared to give up the I. When I do, like Shiva, the truth is there. I am the I that has given up I. And then, as a human being, I am truly attentive. Not attending to something which I picture, not waiting for something to be obtained through my attentiveness, but in that state of selfless unity with the totality, with transcendence, which enables life in its beauty to come to fulfillment and fruition through me, a human individual.